started, please grab a piece of paper and a pen, and the best of luck to you. Question 1. Where do Harry and Draco Malfoy first meet? Question number 2. Upon entering the front doors into the entrance hall of Hogwarts, is the Great Hall on the left or on the right? Question number 3. As Percy
There's no question that kids can get obsessed with the Harry Potter books, and if they don't like Harry Potter, there's always Hunger Games, Twilight, and lots of other books for young adults. So why are kids reading less these days instead of more? We'll talk about that later on in the show. But first, we take a look at a court ruling that says people have a right to be forgotten. That might not necessarily sound like a good thing, but for people trying to put a piece of embarrassing personal history behind them, this sounds like really good news. Europe's highest court has ruled that people can ask Google and other search engines to remove results that paint them in a bad light, even if those results are accurate. Joining me to explain the ruling is Dustin Volz. He writes about technology and policy for the National Journal. Hi, Dustin.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's my pleasure. And this started with a case brought before the EU's Court of Justice by a man from Spain. And tell us briefly what this case was about.
Right. So, the Spanish doctor, he had issues with the Google search results that would appear when you would type his name into the search bar. And there were some newspaper clippings from 1998, actually, when Google was just getting its start, which kind of discussed how he had some debts and was looking to repossess his house in order to repay those debts. And so this is, you know, something that he was true about him, but he didn't exactly find very flattering, and he kind of wanted this to be off the internet because, in his view, it was no longer relevant. He no longer had these debts, and so he pushed his case to the courts, and it went through the European Union system and got all the way up to their Supreme Court, basically, which ruled today that he has a good claim and that Google and other search engines should hold responsibility and honor requests on some cases for people who want to have certain results scrubbed from Google.
So this would just be in the search function. If someone wanted to go to the newspaper site, that information would still be on that particular website.
Right. So there is a distinction to be made here that this case is dealing with search engines, Google, Bing, and others, and it's saying that, you know, this portal that lets you access information, they have to be responsible for what they're displaying. Google is not creating this content by any means, and no one would dispute that. But this ruling is saying, even though Google is not the author of that content, is not the behind those newspaper articles, if that is deemed to be kind of irrelevant or inaccurate or doesn't need to be on their results, then they have to comply with his request, or he can seek legal action against them, which could potentially cost them a lot of money if they don't comply.
And this only applies to EU nationals, people who have EU citizenship?
Right. This applies to all 27 or 28 EU nations. But the internet, you know, exists to share information among different people and across countries. That's what the internet is. So while this is for Europeans, it certainly affects everyone. You and I can't maybe go on and ask Google to get, our high school photos not to appear on Google or, you know, whatever we want. Rick Santorum, who had a Google problem when he was running for president, he's not going to be able to now go and scrub the results. But certainly if we decide we want to look for people, Europeans, maybe our European cousins or, you know, friends that we know out there, celebrities, the results that come through for us could be different. And this kind of changes our internet experience.
Yeah. Well, take, for example, the case of Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who was accused of raping a maid in a New York City hotel room, but he is an EU national. Would then those details, if he complained to Google, because he was never found guilty of that in a court of law, could that then be taken away from a search?
That's a really good question. I think in a case like with DFK, he's going to have a hard time selling that because he is, you know, this kind of public official. He's a known person. And this case, although there's some ambiguity here, it's really meaning to deal with private people and their private lives. It's not meant to be abused by, you know, businesses or elected officials or anything like that. But certainly, you know, the way law is interpreted, we've been surprised before, and we'll be surprised again by how court decisions are interpreted. And so,
well, who does decide, I guess?
Right, right. I mean, this is, it's just like, you know, in our legal system, it's going to be up to the courts when if someone has a petition for Google to take it down, take down a search result, and Google says, no, we're not going to do that, then if they decide to proceed with litigation, they're going to have to determine what is more valuable here. Is the interest of privacy for this individual, does that outweigh the interest for the public to have this information easily available on search engines like Google?
But is Google even interested in fighting these things, or would it just take it down to avoid a legal battle?
That's a good question. It'll be interesting to see how Google and its brethren handles this. Their business model is potentially being upended here in some ways. I mean, they exist by collecting as much data as possible and storing it and displaying it for all of us to see. And it's going to be tough for them to fight a lot of these cases, but I think they're not going to go away quietly. You know, they issued some statements today saying they were very surprised and disappointed by the ruling, and that, you know, this could threaten the internet as we know it, this open and free space that we've come to cherish the way that it operates. So I don't think you've seen the last of Google, but I think they're kind of figuring out where they're going to go next.
And then this could or could not come to the United States, because I think here in the U.S. we have a very different approach to this. The right to privacy is not as cherished as the right to free speech in many cases. It's not codified in the Constitution, for example.
Right, exactly. Certainly, you know, free speech is our most cherished principle in the First Amendment of our Constitution. Europe doesn't have that. Europe has much more codified laws on privacy, and that's what we're seeing here. We kind of have very different approaches that are playing out. So I think the idea that, you know, the Supreme Court would issue a ruling like this in America is unlikely. I think that also you've got to consider the leverage that Google and other Silicon Valley companies would have in the states to prevent something like this. So I don't think we're going to have suddenly the ability to, you know, scrub our data off the internet the way that some Europeans might now have. But again, this does affect our experience. If our searches aren't showing up the same results when we search for European people, that affects our internet experience. So it's kind of a one-way street right now, and I think it's probably going to stay that way for a while.
And then I guess who decides what is defamatory and what is not? I mean, if one person says, look, I don't want my high school yearbook photo out there, or some compromising party photos out there, but, you know, someone else says, well, that's not defamatory, that's just a party. And I don't know, who makes the final decision as to what can remain and what can't?
Right. I mean, that's going to, again, depend on the local authorities. You know, if it's in Spain and they take it to the civil courts out there, they're going to have to ultimately decide. I mean, the way the language is written, it talks about whether or not the information displayed is inaccurate or irrelevant. But I mean, again, what is
that's pretty broad.
Right. What is the standard for, you know, relevancy? You know, this plays out in all sorts of arenas. You know, the NSA surveillance issues that we've been discussing for the last 10 months hinges on the U.S. government's interpretation of relevant data. So, you know, it's the same thing here, where, you know, there's a potentially sweeping court ruling, but it's really unclear exactly how it's going to be interpreted and how many thousands or hundreds of thousands of requests they're going to be hit with now that people can go and try to change the internet, change their history, and be forgotten on Google.
Dustin Volz writes about technology and policy for the National Journal. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Madeline. I appreciate it.
Well, do you have a piece of personal history that's been following you online that you would like to get rid of? Or do you think that the right to free speech trumps the right to privacy? You can share your stories on our listener line, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or on our Facebook, KCRW's Press Play. Well, we may have the right to be forgotten, but is the internet to blame for children reading less? A new report by Common Sense Media, a nonprofit based in San Francisco, finds that teens are reading less for pleasure than they used to. According to the report, about half of 17-year-olds say they read for pleasure fewer than 2 times a year. Well, what about all those blockbuster young adult books like the Harry Potters, the Hunger Games, the Percy Jacksons? Roger Sutton is editor-in-chief of the Horn Book and an expert in children's and young adult literature, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
Well, I'm fine, thank you. The report by Common Sense Media collects a number of studies about reading habits of children and teens, and it says that young children are reading or being read to more, so that sounds like a bit of good news in this. But like I said, teens are reading less. And so what do you make of all this?
I don't know. I've been doing this for more than 35 years, working with children and books in one way or another, and the sky has always been falling. And if the rate of reading decreased among teenagers as steadily as I've heard it for these past 35 years, no one would be reading. But yet people still are reading. Kids still are reading, teenagers and younger children.
And it seems to me, just by going to the bookstore, that there are a lot more books aimed at the YA market now than there ever have been. Is that right?
That's certainly true. But you have to remember that the YA market has changed. That when, I don't know how old you are, but when I was a kid, YA was read by, 10 to 14-year-olds.
Yeah.
And the books today are much more sophisticated and cross over into an adult audience. So it's kind of hard to infer from the sort of growth of that end of the juvenile publishing industry how many of those readers are teens and how many are adults who simply like that genre.
Okay, so adults reading Hunger Games, for example, or Twilight. And there are
exactly.
plenty of those.
Or Eleanor and Park. Have you read that? It won the L.A. Book Prize this year.
Uh-huh, yeah.
It's fabulous, but it's one of those books that has just as much appeal for sort of the young 20-somethings as it does for older teenagers.
So does it also go the other way, that younger and younger kids are reading material that is really meant for an older audience that has racier themes?
I think that's always been true. I think that what we called young adult in the 1970s was intended for 12 years old and up, but really it was us little 9-year-olds, who couldn't wait to get our hands on this juicy stuff that the older kids like.
The Judy Blooms of the world, yeah.
Exactly.
I know, but now there's so much, it seems to be so much more of it.
So much more what?
Of that kind of stuff, the stuff that treads the line of sexuality and violence.
Sure, that's published for teens, but when I was a teen, we got the racy stuff from adult books.
Mm-hmm.
Page 27 of The Godfather, check it out. And it's just that now we see more explicit sort of sexual content in books actually published for young people.
And what about reading online, reading books online? Do you see that as cutting into, or reading anything online, cutting into kids picking up an old-fashioned book?
I think that we'll have to see. At this point, we know kids are not as ingratiated with electronic reading as adults are, which is kind of interesting. But I imagine that the results for both kids and adults are going to rise as the technology gets better and better. It doesn't particularly bother me.
It doesn't bother you that kids are reading electronic books or doing other things online?
Reading electronic books. I think we're all doing other things online. I think that's cut into everybody's reading time.
Right. Well, is there a different experience, do you think, for a teenager or a kid to read online than to read a book in their hands?
Different from the way an adult would experience
it? No. Different in terms of the experience between the two media.
Oh, yeah. I think that electronic media is going to change books for everybody. I think that certain kinds of books work better in electronic form than other kinds do. And I think that those are the books that are going to sort of get a leg up.
So when you look at this study, do you think that that it is basically the sky is falling and we shouldn't worry so much? Or do you think there's anything to it, that there these kinds of reading habits are changing and we're seeing something change for good in terms of what children are getting from their literature?
I don't know. This study is basically a review of the literature. It's
mm-hmm.
it's putting together a whole bunch of studies that have been done and acknowledges that these studies are often contradictory in their findings. I think we always need to pay attention to what kids are reading and how they're reading and how much they're reading. There is no harm in looking at that question over and over and over again, but wringing our hands doesn't do any good.
What does do some good?
I think what does do some good is to make sure that we have all kinds of reading available for all kinds of kids. And grown-ups, too, while we're at it.
So having a lot of books around the house.
Having a lot of the books around the house really helps. Having a wide definition of reading really helps. You know, we often talk about how boys don't read as much as we want them to. But often, when you look at the studies that are looking at gender and reading, what they mean is that boys aren't reading the things we want them to read. That the sorts of things that boys like, for example, the Guinness Book of World Records has always been a boy favorite, doesn't count as reading to someone who values narrative fiction, for example, more highly than informational books or books of lists. So I think we need to be really sort of small-c Catholic in our approach to what counts as reading.
But isn't there a difference in terms of quality when you're reading a real book versus reading something like, I don't know, manga online, which is great and fun to look at, but it doesn't maybe create the same kind of experience of attention and learning new words and learning about narrative structure in the same way as a book with lots of words does?
See, I don't think you can get anywhere with that kind of a comparison, because what if your real book is Twilight and your graphic novel is Boxers and Saints, which is a fabulous book about the Boxer Rebellion for teenagers? Twilight is sort of purpley, can't read it too quickly kind of, you know, fun, entertaining stuff, but it's not great literature, right? So what are you comparing to what?
Okay, so we should be concerned with the actual work itself, not the medium in which it is delivered.
Exactly.
Roger Sutton, editor-in-chief of The Horn Book and an expert on children's books, thanks for joining us.
Sure thing. Thank you.
Well, coming up on the program, we remember Swiss artist H.R. Giger. He created fantastical images and sets he called biomechanical, the melding of man and machine. His most famous creation, the alien from the first Alien movie. That's coming up next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, if you had your wits scared out of you by the Alien movies, you have H.R. Giger partly to thank or to blame. He designed and created that alien creature. Giger died yesterday at the age of 74 in his native Switzerland. One reaction on Twitter, he beautifully articulated our nightmares. Well, here to talk about his life and work is Devin Faraci, regular film critic here on Press Play and the man behind the movie site Badass Digest, and a Giger enthusiast.
I am a fan of Giger's work. Yeah, I would say that's correct.
How did he end up working on Alien?
He came to Alien sort of by accident. He had been working with Alejandro Jodorowsky on Dune, and Dan O'Bannon, who wrote Alien, had been working on Dune as well and got to know Giger and got to know Giger's work. He brought that work to the attention of Ridley Scott. I think specifically it was one of the Necronomicon paintings, and Scott loved the bizarre semi-sexual, biomechanical nightmare stuff that Giger had been doing, and asked him to design what essentially turned into most of the movie. You know, the alien itself is something that we all know is a Giger design. He also designed the facehugger and the chestburster phases of the alien's life. He designed the spaceship in which the alien was found. That all those hallways that looked like bizarre vaginas, that was all H.R. Giger. So the entire aesthetic of what we know as that alien world came from his paintings.
Can you just describe what they look like, his paintings? Because he also did album covers, right?
I mean, the words that he used and sort of become part of our lexicon is biomechanical. And it's this strange place where flesh and machines meet and become indistinguishable. And so a piston can be as much a body part as a body part can be made of metal, and is was, you know, in the 60s and 70s when he was doing this, it was so incredibly forward looking. It feels so clear now as our technology becomes more of a part of us. that this biomechanical stuff was him looking into the future. The idea that the delineation between our technology and our bodies would disappear, was just so prophetic. He also brought a really deeply disturbing sexual element to it. Many of his pieces inspired by genitals. The alien's head itself is an enormous penis. And many of his paintings had all kinds of vaginas and penises and other body parts all over the place.
I did not know that about the alien.
Yeah, it's pretty much a big penis head.
And as you said earlier, he was a painter. And there's a museum dedicated to his work, and I think it's located in a Gothic castle in Switzerland.
Yes.
And did all his paintings have that dark kind of biomechanical sort of heavy metal look to them?
Yeah, I mean, that was really, like, very much what his mind went to. His stuff was really influenced by his own night terrors, which is kind of amazing that his nightmare imageries come directly from nightmares. Everything from his paintings to his sculptures, there's a really terrific sculpture of his called The Birth Machine, which is a gun, and the gun is loaded with human bullets, and which really, to me, just, like, solidifies and exemplifies everything that his aesthetic was about. He used that not just in movies, but also very famously in album covers, Emerson, Lake & Palmer's Brain Salad Surgery, the Cuckoo album cover for Debbie Harry. A lot of metal bands really got into him. He designed a microphone stand specifically for Jonathan Davis of Korn. So he was really influential in that kind of dark and weird side of music as well.
And was he considered a serious artist by the art establishment?
He definitely ended up being considered a pretty serious artist in terms of his work going for tremendous amounts of money. It's impossible to deny the enormous amount of influence that Giger's work had on all kinds of design. And everything from movies, you can see it all over the place in movies, The Matrix, The Birthing Chambers, but also in modern architecture, his biomechanical concepts have sort of worked their way into different building designs. I can't speak particularly well to how the snobbiest of the art critics will find Giger's work, but I do believe that he's become profoundly influential. My favorite piece of Giger influence is that he may have actually created a real world monster. He designed the creature in the movie Species.
Species.
And that movie Species has been sort of folklorists have figured out that the creature in the movie Species is the basis for reports of the creature Chupacabra in the real world. They were able to sort of backdate the original reports of Chupacabra to Puerto Rico to the opening of Species. And the original descriptions of the Chupacabra almost perfectly match the creature in Species. So I kind of love that idea that somebody saw this movie, had a nightmare that night, talked about it to their friends, and then it became a real folklore monster. It's so perfect to me.
And probably Giger would have loved that.
If he ever knew that, probably would have been tickled. Because I'm sure Giger would have probably actually said that the Chupacabra was there all along, that he just, brought it to life, but it had already existed in his nightmares previously.
So, Devin, what was he like as a person? Was he kind of strange?
Well, I never met Giger, but I've watched a lot of interviews with him. I've read a lot about him. And I guess that the simplest way to put it is that he was a real weirdo. When you listen to his interviews, he goes off on these bizarre tangents, and his language is just as weird as his paintings. And he definitely lived like a bizarre vampire in his Gothic castle. He embraced it all to the hilt. His entire home is just full of his art and sculpture. I've had friends who have visited and said that it's the creepiest, weirdest, most amazing place to ever visit. So he definitely, sometimes you'll meet an artist whose work is strange, but whose personal life is actually kind of boring. Giger was the exact opposite. He leaned heavily into being the wearing all black, talking in cryptic, weird sentences, and living in a Gothic castle kind of a guy.
So he really lived his art. He was his art.
Just as his biomechanical paintings saw no difference between machines and humans, his life saw no difference between his art and his day-to-day life.
Devin Faraci, regular film critic here on Press Play. He also runs the movie site Badass Digest. And we are remembering H.R. Giger, who died yesterday at the age of 74 in Switzerland. Coming up, how can one person handle all the sexual abuse complaints at a university? Not well. We'll find out what needs to change on college campuses. Also, what if you're not ready to go to college right after high school? Enter the Gap Year Consultant. Those stories are next after this news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Press play. I'm Madeline Bram.
If I saw it happening, I'd never blame her. I'd help her.
Because I don't want to be a part of the problem.
I want to be a part of the solution.
We need all of you to be part of the solution. This is about respect. It's about responsibility.
It's up to all of us to put an end to sexual assault. And that starts with you.
Because one is too many.
That's a PSA featuring President Obama, Vice President Biden, and stars like Daniel Craig and Benicio del Toro raising awareness about campus sexual assault. The federal government is bringing attention to the issue of sexual assault on campus, and it's up to the Department of Education to enforce rules about sexual discrimination on campus. Those rules fall under Title IX. Each college or university has one person on campus who's in charge of administering Title IX, according to the rules. And Brett Sokolow is executive director of the Association of Title IX Administrators. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. So who are these people keeping track of Title IX on campuses?
Well, on most college campuses, you're talking about a senior-level administrator who has the role of what's called a Title IX coordinator. They usually have a shared responsibility, so being a Title IX coordinator is part of their roles, and their other roles may or may not relate to Title IX at all.
So it's not a full-time job right now on most campuses to enforce these Title IX rules?
On most campuses, it should be a full-time job. It's certainly enough. There's enough responsibility to consume someone full-time, but I don't think the campuses are making that decision to allocate the resources that way yet.
Right. And then Title IX isn't just about campus assaults. It's also about sports.
Yeah, exactly. The campus Title IX coordinator is responsible for all program access. And any program access that's denied on the basis of sex or gender falls within Title IX. So that would include athletics. It would include the right of female faculty members to advance in their employment roles within a particular department. Title IX covers gender identity issues. All of that winds up being covered under the federal statute.
So how is it that any one person can keep up with all these things on one campus?
Well, it's one more person than we had before, so I appreciate the question. It's a realistic one. You know, how can one person keep up with all of this, especially since they're responsible for prevention, they're responsible for remedies, they're responsible for all case tracking and resolutions, and making sure that employees, sometimes thousands of employees and students are trained.
All right, and why are there so many investigations now?
Well, there are more than 50 investigations of colleges and universities right now, and I think the reason why it is the highest number of investigations that OCR has ever had has a lot to do with this administration wanting to turn up the heat on colleges and universities to get them compliant with Title IX. But I think you also have to attribute a lot of the complaints to the effectiveness of social media. A lot of women have banded together in groups like EdAct Now and Know Your Nine and communicate with each other via a number of different social media mechanisms to support each other, to talk through how they file complaints. And so a lot of the complaints that are happening right now are coming out of these activist groups who have come together out of common cause and met up on the Internet.
So with all this activism on campus and all this attention from the White House, what does this mean for the Title IX administrator? Are you getting tons of calls from people overwhelmed?
Yes, they're absolutely drowning, and they still face the challenge that their presidents and boards of trustees don't understand the enormity of the compliance challenge. And so, coordinators are really struggling. What I've been spending most of my time on the last couple of weeks, in higher education, April is the highest volume month for sexual assaults, always has been. So all of those...
Wait, why? Why is that?
There are probably a lot of different reasons, but I think it's the last chance to party before finals. And by the time we investigate, we're in the middle of May, but by the time we're dealing with it. So over the last couple of weeks, I've just been dealing with left and right campuses coming to me with fact patterns and saying, what do we do with this kid? How do we address this one? And it's wild because, you know, sometimes they're so far off that you feel like at the end of the day, you kept four people from being expelled who didn't do anything wrong, and you made sure that three cases went forward, that the campus was about to dismiss, and now you've protected the victims who weren't going to be, and it's sort of like preventing disaster left and right, but it has been really intense for the last few weeks.
Wow, that's interesting. Why aren't they equipped to handle this? Do they just not know how to handle a sexual assault complaint?
Well, why are they not equipped to handle it? A lot of them don't have the background in this area. And frankly, you know, after doing this for 17 years, I think I'm pretty good at it, but I have 17 years worth of experience looking at this from 360 degrees, and I have law training. And so, you know, I think we're asking campus administrators to do something that they're not prepared for, they haven't had the training for, and I think in many ways it's impossible to ask them to figure these things out. And, you know, when we train coordinators, one of our most prominent roles in the field has been to train and certify Title IX coordinators. We've done this with more than 2,000 of them. After 4 days of training with us, they're barely ready. And so there's a learning curve. And I think a lot of the coordinators have been doing this for a number of years now. They're getting really quite good at it, but it takes some experience once you go back out of the training seminar to deploy the skills and to learn what the real life cases are like on your campus before you really can become truly proficient.
Isn't there a disincentive in a sense for them to pursue these cases, because the more they pursue these cases, the more it'll look like they have a problem on their campus?
You know, that was the old days, and I'm not saying there aren't a few campuses out there that are reputation conscious that way, but most aren't corrupt. I think where you do see corruption now and the reputation consciousness is still with athletes in prominent athletics programs, where the campus may have some incentive not to move this forward appropriately. But I would say 98% of campuses, in, you know, 90%+ of cases, are really genuine about wanting to do this right. Campuses have learned not responding to these instances is what's bad for business, because that just gets you on the front page and in the lawsuit. So I do think there's a lot of a very genuine effort out there to tackle a task that is just huge.
Well, why not set up a discrete, separate office for sexual assaults and staff it with people who do have experience in the real world with sexual assaults, and have those people, people who know how to handle victims, people who know how to handle the criminal justice system, what have you, and have those people handle these complaints and leave the other administrative issues to the administrators?
Interesting thought. I think some campuses are certainly setting up dedicated offices, but I think if you ask the question, you know, how do you staff the people who know how to do this already, this is its own animal. So when you ask the question, why don't we just put a lot of people who already know how to do this in those positions, you know, outside of my firm and a few other people who do this kind of work, that doesn't exist.
That's shocking to me. This is a huge issue in our culture, in our society. I think the statistics are 1 in 5 women on campus will be sexually assaulted.
Or the victims of attempted assault. Yeah, it's startlingly high. And I like the message from the public service announcement that one is too many, because I think there's just too much debate about how frequently this occurs. And I think the whole point is that campuses have to be safe spaces for every student. And what we spend a lot of time on in our field is responding. You know, how do we adjudicate? How do we investigate? Well, if we spent a whole lot more time and resources on prevention, I think we'd have less to respond to.
Well, I want to thank you very much. Really interesting conversation.
My pleasure.
Brett Sokolow is Executive Director of the Association of Title IX Administrators in Philadelphia. The end of the school year is fast approaching, and for high school seniors, that means college next fall for a lot of them, or maybe not. Maybe it's a year off, a gap year, a break, a time to figure out where you want to go, what you want to do with your life, but not a time to just lie around on the couch watching The Price is Right, eating a giant bowl of cereal. No. So enter the Gap Year Consultant. Maureen Lavin-Arcand is a Gap Year Consultant, and she joins us now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. Good to be here.
What is a Gap Year Consultant? What do you do?
Well, I consider a Gap Year Consultant sort of a facilitator for students, parents, schools to help kids decide the possibilities that are out there for what they could do for their gap year. We're there to kind of find the right fit for them in what their vision is.
What if they don't have a vision? Or what if their vision is more like, I just want to take a break. I've been studying so hard, taking all these tests, just going for the last 12 years. I just want to just
Well, then
relax.
That's why we are here. Because I think nowadays, they have been going. And they do want to do something a little different and something that's not, that may push them over the comfort line, but not be majorly academically challenging. And they look to us to make sense of the thousands of options that are out there.
And what are some of those options?
If you can dream it, you can do it. It ranges everywhere from you could become a game ranger in Africa. You could teach children in South America. You could help turtles protect hatchlings. You could climb Kilimanjaro. There is almost nothing you can't do now.
Hmm. This all sounds really amazing. Is it expensive?
It can be. Very little out there is on the low end. There are things you can farm, an organization you can farm with anywhere in the world. And that is really room and board in exchange for labor. So it ranges from that up to you could pay $25,000 for 3 months.
To do what for 3 months?
Well, for an example, you could travel throughout Italy and be taking art courses and going to museums and being taught by some really incredible people about the art and architecture. You could travel globally on a tall ship that is out for 3 months, so you're on land for a very short period of time.
And how much do you charge, or does a typical gap year consultant charge?
Gap year consultants generally charge between, say, $1,800 and $2,200 for their services. And in general, that covers finding opportunities, connecting the students with it, following them through and making sure that they go. And we're there afterwards, even if they get back, as we've had some kids who are in college but maybe looking for a summer opportunity.
I wonder if colleges now look at gap years and look at those students and see what they do during their gap years.
Colleges love gap years. They feel that they get a more mature student, a responsible student, someone that's kind of been there and done the typical drinking, partying, perhaps. It's over. They're ready to get into their academics. There are colleges now that are running their own gap years.
Oh.
We have one here in Boston. Tufts just announced that they are running a gap year. Their program is called 1+4.
And what's in it for them, for Tufts?
I think they get a more motivated student. I hate to say it from this point of view, but I think there's a marketing side to it. Mm. But the students really do gain something from it. So it is out there, and colleges have loved it for quite a while. Many are very willing to defer to have a student take a gap year.
What if you're a student who can't afford to take a gap year or pay for a consultant such as yourself? Is there anything for that student?
There are many opportunities that offer scholarships. There are some programs that give college credit, then your FAFSA, your college money, could be paying for that semester.
Back when you went to college, did you take a gap year?
I did not. I don't think I even knew there was such a thing as a gap year at the time. It just kind of wasn't heard of. But I think there's been an explosion in talking about it. It has been around for a long time in Europe, in the UK. But over the past 5 to 10 years has really taken off.
And why do you think that is?
I think more kids are hearing about it, for one thing. There is an organization that puts on gap fairs throughout the country. The more kids take it, the more they tell someone else about it. And I think the stress of school and the competition of getting into colleges makes the last few years of high school very stressful. And sometimes kids will take it for that reason.
You know, I can see that some kid spends a year doing something fabulous out in, I don't know, out in Africa or hanging out with Tibetan monks or what have you, and says, you know what, I want to go to college. This is the life for me. Does that ever happen?
You know, I'm sure it does. I would never say never. We have never had a student not go on to college. 90% of our students have deferred already, so they know that they're going to be going upon their return.
What about for grown-ups? Now I'm hearing all this, I'm thinking maybe I should take a gap year. Sounds like so much fun.
Yes, there are gap years for grown-ups, and many organizations now don't necessarily just take gap year students. They will take anyone from 18 to 70 or whatever their age range is, because you can put all different age groups in a situation and they will complement one another.
Maureen Lavin Arcand is a gap year consultant. Her business is called Taking Off. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much for having me.
All right, so what do you think? What do you think about this idea of gap year consultants? Do you think kids are well served by taking a year off between high school and college? And what do you think about what they should be doing during that year? Should they go on a fun trip hanging out with monks in Thailand, or should they get a job at the local Burger King? You can leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, KCRW's Press Play. Coming up, what happens when we do all our food ordering online, how we change our behavior when we're in private. That story is coming up next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Hi. What can I get you?
I'll have a number 3.
I'd like the chef salad, please, with the oil and vinegar on the side and the apple pie a la mode.
Chef and apple a la mode.
But I'd like the pie heated, and I don't want the ice cream on top. I want it on the side, and I'd like strawberry instead of vanilla if you have it. If not, then no ice cream, just whipped cream, but only if it's real. If it's out of a can, then nothing.
Not even the pie?
No, just the pie, but then not heated.
Uh-huh.
Meg Ryan, of course, in When Harry Met Sally. Sally really had no problem ordering exactly what she wanted, but that's not really true all the time for the rest of us. Many of us are embarrassed to make orders that are too weird, or we order too much or too little food. Well, enter online ordering. Apps for ordering food online are everywhere. Grubhub, Snapfinger, Seamless, Foodler, Eat24, not to mention all the restaurant chains that have their own online ordering apps. And people are using them and changing their behavior in terms of what they're ordering. Ryan McDevitt teaches economics at Duke University, and he joins us now. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. And you actually study people's online food ordering behavior?
We did. We actually had the opportunity to look at a pizza chain here in North Carolina, and they've historically tracked their sales because when you order, they have to deliver it to you so they know exactly who's ordering what and when. And this chain, they introduced online ordering about 3 years ago, and we can see this nice distinct break there in the ordering history. Some consumers were ordering before when it was just over the phone or at the counter, but then when they moved their purchases online, they made very different decisions. They were getting extra bacon toppings. They were getting extra cheese. They're making very picky orders, and it's, you know, I think a very interesting phenomenon to look at and kind of consistent with what we saw with Meg Ryan and historically these anecdotes, but now we have some data behind it to see systematically what's going on.
Yeah, so does that surprise you at all that people feel more free to indulge themselves, I should say, when they're in private?
Not surprising, no. I think there's a long line of literature and social psychology. You know, we're social creatures, so when others we feel are judging us in some way, we behave differently. And you know, especially when it comes to food orders and food choices, it's kind of fraught with this possibility of being judged negatively. And so, you know, we order very simple things with a lot of people around us, but then when we're more private, you know, it's online or anonymous, we make different choices.
So basically, if I'm on a diet, I should not order online.
I think that's absolutely right. Or you should, you know, have someone standing behind you looking over your shoulder, maybe judging you a little bit when you're ordering.
There's also a similar study involving Swedish liquor stores. And what happened there?
Exactly. It's in the paper as well. In Sweden, they had a government-run alcohol monopoly retailer. And historically, what they did was you'd go like at a pharmacy, you go to the counter, you ask for your order, and they go to the back of the store to pick up the products. And so that means you have to verbally pronounce any type of brand or alcohol that you'd like to purchase. And if you're gone to look at some of these French wines, it could be a mouthful. And so you can imagine if you're, you know, not sure of how to pronounce this name, you might just go next down on the list and order the one that's more familiar to you. And so we see when they experiment with going to the more traditional self-service at the shelf level, people were then more willing to order these complicated French wines that they wouldn't have before.
And that's just a function of being embarrassed to pronounce.
Again, you know, you don't want to look like you're an unsophisticated rube who doesn't know how to pronounce this, you know, $100 bottle of wine you're going to purchase.
So I imagine, though, if you're ordering more when you're ordering online, that businesses are loving this.
So far, that's the data we found. The online customer is about 20% more profitable for the chain we looked at. And, you know, places like Domino's, Papa John's, they're also seeing this huge uplift. Somewhere close to 50% of the orders now are coming online, which is, I think, just remarkable.
And do they have prompts when you order online to upsell you things?
Yes, they've become more sophisticated with how they approach this. You know, historically, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, it was just a website. But now they're telling you, add that extra layer of cheese or, you know, get the extra bacon topping. So they're really prompting you to do this now.
So I can imagine this is happening not just in restaurants or liquor stores, but in lots of other businesses too.
Again, this is way back to the beginning of the internet, something like Amazon. I picked up on this right away that you're going to purchase different things when you're not, you know, browsing the shelves of Barnes & Noble. So 50 Shades of Grey is a perfect example of this. A lot of people attribute the fact that it was so successful is that a lot of the purchases were on the Kindle, right? So no one could see the cover of the book you were reading. You'd have to go to the shelves and have everyone aware that you're buying smut in the bookstore. But when it's anonymous, you know, no one knows what you're reading on the subway. You know, might make a different type of literature purchase.
Right. And there's online porn to take it one step further.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Right. And so is there a downside to this aside from gaining weight and doing things that might not be socially acceptable?
Well, there's certainly the social perspective that maybe now we're, you know, in some ways, judgment of others can be beneficial if you're going to try to stick to that diet or maybe consume entertainment that's not socially acceptable. So I think there's always that downside. But from a libertarian perspective, you know, everyone that is free to choose what they most desire, there's some benefit to that as well.
Okay. But you might not do that if you order bacon on your Domino's pizza. You want to keep that private.
I think so.
Ryan McDevitt teaches economics at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business, and he studies people's online food ordering behavior. Thanks so much.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Press Play senior producer Andrew Walsh is here sitting in for Jolie Myers with the mail. And first, before you get there, I want to ask you to be public about your online food ordering.
Oh my gosh.
Behavior.
I mean, how public do I need to be? There's not enough shame deflectors in the world to talk about this. Grubhub has changed my life. It's the amount of food that I now order because I don't have to talk to a human being. It is disgusting.
How many of those little plastic knives and forks do you get for
That's
one order?
That's exactly right. We were asking our press players about how ordering online affects them, and they say, Robert wrote in to say, yeah, the amount of food that I order is always reflecting the number of fortune cookies I get, and it's shameful, he says, especially when he's ordering for himself. And we got a note from Elliot on our Facebook page that said, oh, God. I often pretend like I'm ordering for multiple people when I'm actually only ordering for myself. I say things like, we'd like this, and we'd like that, and I gotta say, it reminds
me of... The Royal We?
You like Key and Peele, right?
Yeah.
The sketch comedy show. This is a skit from Key and Peele that is right dead on. This is a, let's say, a large man in his apartment by himself ordering pizza.
We would like a large pie with pepperoni pineapple and cheesy crust.
Large pepperoni with pineapple and cheesy crust. Okay, is that going to complete your order, sir?
You know what? Let me gauge the room. Guys, are we going to want another pizza? Let me just, who's hungry? Show of hands. Let me see them. One, two, three, keep them up.
That is funny because it is so close to reality. By the way, in that scene, he is talking to his action figures. let's see. Here's
lots of action. They get hungry.
Well,
they're
what about
lots.
You? I have tons of feedback I could get to, but let's put you on the spot
a
little bit.
Don't
yes.
you dare.
Do you ever order from like online or any of these apps? You're probably too good. You're probably eating kale and pita.
Sometimes I put bacon on my kale in private.
that's as bad as it gets for you. we also got a note after your interview with H.R. Giger. Mark wrote in to say to truly appreciate Alien, the Giger Alien. I recommend watching the first Alien movie outtakes, and you hear Ridley Scott talk about his encounters with his artist and the appreciation and the creative process, and he says it's on YouTube, so we should all check it out.
Yay. Well, thank you, Andrew Walsh.
Thank you.
I'll let you get back to your online food ordering. Yeah. And that's it for us today. To the Point with Warren Olney is up next. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you all tomorrow.